This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. In the past month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the state has no place in the consensual sex lives of its citizens, while north of the border, Canada's prime minister vowed to legalize gay marriage. Those two events have put the private union of individuals at the center of a very public debate about the role of government in marriage. But this hardly is the first time wedding vows have been caught up in political rhetoric. The government has long had a stake in who gets married and how. Marriage law determines everything from how the state collects taxes to who is responsible for the next generation of citizens. Today, we look at the politics of marriage, its history, and its future. Our question to you is both personal and political. Why do you get married? Is it all an expression of love, religion, and tradition, or do the legal questions of property, custody, and immigration play a role? Where do you feel the hand of the state is in your marriage? Is there another route? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Harvard American History Professor Nancy Cott. She's also the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. Thanks for being with us, Professor Cott.
I'm glad to be here.
What is the basis for marriage law in the United States?
Well, it stems from an inheritance, really, in Anglo-American law that the English state, the British state, had long had control over marriage as an aspect of its power over its population's lives. And from the very beginning of the American nation, at the time of the American Revolution, it was assumed that states would want to regulate marriage. It was one of the very first things that colonial governments did when they were established. And in those days, of course, this was a non-contracepting population. It was very important for the state to be able to regularize the results of sex and to have some responsible adults in line to take care of those children who resulted. And also, marriage served very usefully for the state to regularize property transmission and make it predictable. I think those two things, sex and property, really have to do with why the state, the modern state, has been interested in controlling marriage.
And how has the law evolved since its beginnings?
Well, that's a complicated question to answer. I think most people focus on the recent years and really in the past two generations. I think there's been more change in marriage law than in the previous 200, in that certain basics remain true. States don't want other entities, like churches, for instance, in the United States, to have the ultimate control over marriage. Marriage has been a secular, civil matter in the United States since the beginning. But in the longer past, I think that there was far more explicit connection between morality and the law, that is, and through the institution of marriage, than there is now. Let me put it this way. In the legal structure, there used to be a really bright line between what was moral and what was immoral, and those things that were immoral were often called criminal. And what drew that line was whether the sexual behavior took place inside or outside marriage. That's no longer true. That really fell into disuse during the 20th century. And in the past 30 years, there's been more and more attention of the law to how households function and who's responsible for minors and dependents, whether or not there is a legal marital tie. If there's a family or household tie, then courts will enforce responsibilities among household groups, whether or not marriage exists.
You said a moment ago that the state always felt that churches should not have control over marriage. But in this country, it seems, anyway, that religion and government have sort of walked hand in hand down the aisle for a long time.
I totally agree. What was underpinning states' assumption that they would control was an absorption of Christian doctrine of marriage. And certainly in the longer past of American marriage law, you can see the presumption that a Christian modeled marriage is what is being sought and what is being supported. In my own work on the history of marriage, what I was most interested in was the way that a particular model of marriage and institutionalizing that model, encouraging people to take it up, has been a part of public policy in the United States ever since its founding. And that this model was a Christian model, lifelong monogamous marriage between a man and a woman, and until very recently, between a man and a woman of the same race. That was part of public policy as well as the basic consensual Christian basis of it.
We're talking about the role of the state in marriage, and we are taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255. And let's take a call now from Joe, and he's in Farmington, Michigan, I believe it is. Hi, Joe.
Hello, good afternoon. Okay. I just had a comment. I've recently gotten married about just under a year ago. My wife and I are getting ready to celebrate our first anniversary, and we're both non-religious, and I think that the commitment that we made to each other was made even before we actually were officially sanctioned by the state as a married couple, and mostly we got married so that we could have a document for financial reasons, for insurance reasons, for legal reasons, whereas our true commitment was something that was a personal bond between the two of us.
So you didn't really feel that you needed marriage for anything other than legal reasons, essentially, you're saying, or because you were concerned about what might happen in the future with your finances?
I think we needed marriage. I think that there was a marriage between the two of us. I don't think that it happened because we were able to get a license from the state. I think it happened because there was a meeting of minds and soul between the two of us. And we have a date that says this is the day that we are officially married. But for me, it happened, you know, long before then. And it was just kind of, that was the end of the beginning of our relationship and the beginning of the rest of our life together.
So marriage for you really is just, it's a personal commitment.
That's right. And I think that has changed from my parents' time because they certainly were not happy that we did not have a big wedding and had lots of guests and friends and family there. We had a very small wedding, not in our hometown, and it was just the two of us and two friends who we needed as witnesses. If we had our druthers, I don't think that even our friends would have been there. It would have just been us and the person who performed the service.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Joe.
Thank you.
I think Joe's call reflects, I don't know how wide a trend it is. I don't know that we have any numbers on it, but certainly there's a trend there among people who either people make the commitment personally and don't even bother with the legal marriage part of it. They're living together and that's all they need, or they regard it as a very personal, very private decision.
Right. I think that most people do think of marriage, whether they legalize it or not, as a personal matter. And it is a personal matter. What's fascinating about the institution is that it is simultaneously public and private. People tend to think only of the private side unless pushed or unless they're thinking very instrumentally, like Joe was. That is, we needed to get married legally to have certain pieces of paper for certain purposes. But typically, all of the sentimental rhetoric about marriage does stress that it's a personal bond, which it has to be, of course, if it's going to last. Nonetheless, that doesn't dispute the fact that there's a tremendous institutional apparatus at the public level built around marriage and intersected with marriage that is one of its characteristics, its essential characteristics.
What is the state's interest in controlling marriage?
Well, I'd mentioned that controlling the effects of sex and of property transmission are important. I think that the state today, even as before, wants to make sure that dependent minors are cared for by responsible adults so that those minors don't have to be supported by public funds. And marriage is one form of assuring that. These days, pressing obligations on parents, whether they are legally married or not, is another way. And certainly that's part of our law. But marriage is the most satisfactory vehicle that Western governments have found so far to take care of the provision of minors, to have a vehicle through which to enforce those obligations. Maybe even more basically, since the institution of marriage exists, the state wants to control it simply as a means of control over its population and over the reproduction of its population. We're a government of popular sovereignty. It means it matters who the people are. And if legal progeny are produced in marriage, and those legal residents and citizens are the population, then the state wants to be the one holding the reins over the making of those marriages.
Okay. Let's take a call from Eric in Minneapolis. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Yes?
Yes, go ahead, Eric.
Okay. Back in 1986, my wife and I decided to get married, and what we decided was to simply have a religious marriage, not go get a piece of paper from the state. And we decided to do that for two reasons. One was the historically, a lot of the state involvement in a contract between husband and wife and, like you said, property rights and requiring a wife to follow her husband, we felt uncomfortable with that and wanted to define our own relationship. And then also, perhaps more importantly, we felt like it was not proper for us to benefit from the legal perks that you get with marriage when our friends, gay and lesbian friends, were not allowed those same legal perks. But we thought that was important to be married in a religious setting to make public our relationship and to involve our friends and family in supporting our relationship. And so that's why we decided to go ahead and have a religious ceremony.
So are you saying you had a religious ceremony, but you didn't go and get a marriage license?
That's
and,
right.
So you're not legally wed then?
We're not legally wed. Huh. And as a result, we've had to, draft powers of attorney. We drafted a legally binding contract that went into what our relationship was and conditions for dissolving it if that ever happened and all of that, which was actually a lot more bother than going down to City Hall. But
well, I'm very curious, what church were you or what under what religious auspices were you married?
Well, we're members of a non-denominational worshiping community. We had members of several different religions participating in our service, Lutheran, UCC, and several Unitarian. So we had a number of different people doing different things in our service.
All right. Well, Eric, that's a very interesting insight into the whole marriage discussion that we're having here on Talk the Nation. Thanks so much for your call.
Could I add one more thing?
I'm going to have to take a break very soon. So quickly.
The one thing that I would add is that we've given some thought to perhaps going to Canada now that they recognize marriages of gays and lesbians, that might be an option for us that we would feel morally okay with.
All right. Those good old neighbors to the north, eh? Okay. Thanks so much for your call. We're talking about the legal institution of marriage, its role in society, and its future as an institution. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about marriage today and the role of the state in defining the legal union of two people. If you have a comment on this issue, give us a call at 1-800-989-TALK. We've been talking with Nancy Codd, a professor of American history at Harvard University, and joining us now is Mike McManus. He believes that government needs to put more muscle into marriage by making it harder to wed and harder to get divorced. McManus is the founder of Marriage Savers. He writes a syndicated column titled Ethics and Religion, and he joins us by phone from Potomac, Maryland. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Thank you, Lynn. Hi.
Mike, why should it be harder to get married and to get divorced?
Well, a lot of people are entering into marriage rather lightly, and they really need much more marriage preparation. In our church, we require anybody getting married to go through a premarital inventory and meet with a mentor couple 6 evenings and go to a bunch of classes and so forth. And the result of that is we've only had a 3% divorce rate since 1992. So it is possible to give people rigorous marriage preparation. And one state that approximates this is Minnesota, where your recent caller just came from. And out there, if you go through 12 hours of preparation and you take a premarital inventory, the state will cut your cost, the cost of your marriage certificate, in half. And so that gives you an incentive to take serious marriage preparation.
Now, you were mentioning that this is this kind of program is something that that you do in your church, but why should the state be doing it? Why is this something that the state should be involved
obvious.
In?
Obvious. I mean, to me, the issue of divorce is a much more serious issue than gay marriage. We have had 35 million children see their parents walk away from each other and from them since 1970. And, you know, for them, marriage was destroyed. These are these children of divorce who, as they grow up, are the people who are inclined to cohabit rather than marry. And those who do think they're in a trial marriage, but they're really in a trial divorce, they're going to learn to break up either before the wedding or after. There's a very high breakup rate at both ends. And it's not their fault. They just haven't. They've never had an idea of what real marriage is because they saw their parents divorce. So this is the more serious problem. And one of the reasons that marriages fail is that some people are marrying the wrong person. By taking a detailed premarital inventory like Prepare or Focus, which are taken now by about 700,000, 800,000 couples who get married, about a third of those who marry take one of these inventories. It helps the couple to get an objective view of their strengths and weaknesses, and it also gives an older couple, a mentoring couple or a pastor, information about the couple that can help them surface issues that need to be discussed and hopefully resolve them before there is a wedding.
I guess I'm wondering, I can see how this might work very well in a church setting in a particular denomination, and of course a number of religions have a history of prenuptial counseling. But then I wonder, when you move it to the state level, you're dealing with people who, unlike in church, they may not have the same values, systems of the. How do you come up with an inventory that works for everybody?
The state simply says, if you bring a certificate that you've had 12 hours of marriage preparation, this could be by a secular counselor. It doesn't have to be by a church. And you've taken a premarital inventory, and you have a certificate that you've done that, then we will reduce your cost of your marriage license. It's not a big deal. It's going from maybe, I'm not exactly sure, $75 to $30 or something like that.
We got lots of calls. I want to get to them. But before we do, Mike, if you could just give us an idea, what is that inventory? Not the whole thing, but what are some of the questions you'd ask?
Statements on which the man and woman agree or disagree. We put them in separate rooms when they're answering it. For example, sometimes my future spouse gives me the silent treatment when we get into arguments. I find it difficult to say I'm sorry even when I'm wrong. I don't like the way my future spouse spends money. We're going to bring our children up in the church. A whole range of questions like that cover almost 200 issues in marriage preparation. So the couple then answers those things, and we get back a computerized report comparing what the man and woman said on each issue. So you can immediately see where there are conflicts and where there are agreements. You can compliment them on their agreements, and we train our mentors to go over every single item on the inventory. This is something that pastors don't have time for. But a couple who's 50 years old and takes, you know, one or two couples a year can afford to invest a significant amount of time in a couple preparing for marriage. We're a nation of 350,000 congregations, you know, churches, synagogues, mosques, and marriage is an important part of their life. But the data shows that people who go to church are just as likely to get divorced. Protestants are even more likely to get divorced than those who are unbelievers, really.
Yeah.
According to a poll by George Barna.
So let me just ask you one other question about the inventory. So if people find out through this inventory that if the inventory says they're not compatible, then
what? Give an example. A woman and a man who were both about 40 took the inventory. They actually scored the highest scores of any of the couples who took it that particular spring. But when they sat down and started talking about children, he said, "I don't want to have children." He said, "Well," she said, "well, to me, marriage means children." He said, "Not to me, it doesn't. You know, my marriage love for you has got to be enough. I don't want to be supporting a kid in college while I'm in retirement." You know, and so even though they had good scores, this was an irreconcilable difference, and they found it out, fortunately, beforehand. Another example is a woman who we mentored recently, and partway through she discovered that he was very deep into pornography. And he said he would do something about it, but he really didn't. And so she saw that she was going to be marrying a guy who was more addicted to pornography than he was to having sex with her. And she, I think, wisely got out of the marriage.
All right, we're talking about marriage, and let's take a call now from Russ in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Russ.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm at the tail end of what will be a 28-year marriage by the time we get a final, well, not a final order, but an order next week. And we've been separated 3 years, two grown children, and I guess my view is that that the function of marriage in this society is to regularize the property relationships between two people, and to, as your first guest mentioned, to control the responsibility for the upbringing of children. Of course, my children are both grown. But I guess I'm about to find out next week what the state thinks is my obligation in terms of continued maintenance. I gave her all the property, so that shouldn't be an issue. But I do think that there's a huge societal pressure on young people to get married and to make a commitment which, as your more recent guest has been saying, that I really don't understand. I'm not sure that I favor inventories because, frankly, I think back then, 27 years ago, that my wife and I probably would have done fairly well in the inventory. I'd have to see all 150 questions. But, I mean, things happen to people over time, and
yeah.
People grow in different directions, and then there's this legal institution hanging over your head, which tells you that that you can't break apart. And that if you break apart, there's leverage on one side or the other to make it more difficult. And I just I'm although a lot of people would say maybe that a 25-year marriage was a successful quote unquote marriage, I am very sour on the institution of marriage.
And I would bet, Russ, that you didn't see it as merely a legal institution when you went into it.
But we were both young and stupid back then, and I think. Fairly early on, we both saw that you know, forever was going to be a very long time.
Well, you said you're in St. Louis, did you say?
Yeah.
St. Louis has a weekend retreat called RetroVi, and this is all over the United States, but I happen to have St. Louis's number right here.
Yeah.
And four out of five couples who go to this weekend retreat which is run by couples whose own marriages had nearly failed, tell you their stories of how they nearly divorced and then how they rebuilt their marriages. It's very inspirational. They ask you to write to each other for 10 minutes at a time on questions like, what is it I have difficulty talking to you about and how does that make me feel? And then you go back.
I'm pretty sure that my wife and I are so far beyond that. I don't mean to discard your...
Well, I'm only saying that this intervention,
yeah.
Everyone who goes to this feels the same way, that it's hopeless. But they say four out of five marriages. So there is an alternative to staying in a bad marriage or divorcing, and the alternative is to improve it. And that's an important thing to do, even if you're not able
okay.
to do it personally.
I guess I would have to say that the state of Missouri and every state had forced me to stay in a bad marriage 15 years or 10 years at least, longer than it was advisable for either of us psychologically to stay in it.
Okay, Russ, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to ask Nancy Cott also to comment because I think she would come to Russ's contribution here, his comment here, from a different perspective. Nancy Cott.
Let me just mention, his comments made me think it was important to say that if we look back to the time when marriage was first imagined as a lifelong bond, a lifelong sexually faithful bond, at that period of time, people did not live as long as people do now. And even up until as recently as 75 or 100 years ago, people did not envision having marriages typically that could last 30 years, if they married in their 20s, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. Of course, some marriages did, but it was rare. And in the imagined idyllic times people look back to, which may not have existed since divorce has been around a long time in America, but even in the 19th century, people's marriages typically lasted 15 to 20 years. That was a long marriage because one partner or the other would die before more years than that had elapsed. And I think we need a perspective on modern marriage which acknowledges that it's a phenomenon in and of itself, lifelong marriages in a period in which people can hopefully live through their 70s still married if they should want to. It's not that it's always been this way. This is new.
All right, Mike, I just want to ask you one more question before you have to go. You said earlier that you think divorce is even more of a problem than gay marriage, but what is your take on gay marriage?
Well,
would it strengthen or weaken the institution of marriage?
It would weaken the institution of marriage because it would place children in homes brought up by two people of the same gender. And I think a healthy upbringing involves people of both genders because the male and the female have differing gifts to give the child, and that child would miss out on a whole half of its possible upbringing. And it would also have a twisted conception of what sex is, and from my point of view. And I think that it would be terrible if we legalized same-sex marriages. But the bigger problem is not with gays, which are only 3% of the population, but with heterosexuals who have really made a mess of heterosexual marriage. And that's the bigger problem, and it's the one that conservatives tend to gloss over rather quickly in talking about gay marriage.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike McManus is the founder of Marriage Savers. He writes a syndicated column titled Ethics and Religion, and he joined us by phone from Potomac, Maryland. And with us now to present a differing vision of the future of marriage is law professor Nancy Polakoff. She joins us from her office at American University's Law School here in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Nancy.
Happy to be here.
Now, unlike our most recent guest, you think that we can do without the legal institution of marriage entirely. How so?
Well, I actually think we do better without the legal institution of marriage. What we have now is a state creation that imbues many rights and benefits to the status of marriage, to the relationship between two adults who have a primary sexual affiliation to each other, or as a Canadian report I'll talk about momentarily refers to it as a conjugal relationship. That relationship then is considered much more important than any other relationship that any individual can have throughout their life. And because of that, it gets a variety of rights and benefits under the law. And I think that's a mistake. At the moment, it does mean that lesbian and gay couples who can't marry are second-class citizens, but I am equally concerned that even if we have lesbian and gay marriage, that then the second-class citizens will simply be all the people whose economic and emotional interdependence are with non-spouse-like individuals. Those relationships will be second-class relationships. So if you are married, you will have someone who can take family leave from the workforce to take care of you when you're ill. But if you're unmarried, then no matter how close your closest friend or your cousin or your grandchild who might be willing to care for you, those people will not be able to. Because they're not married to you.
Nancy Polakoff is a professor of law at American University Law School, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Polakoff, we heard earlier Professor Nancy Cott say that one of the main interests that government has in the institution of marriage is the protection of children. So what happens to the children in the kind of marriage situation you're talking about?
Well, as Professor Cott said, at the moment, the legal regime about responsibilities for children is completely untethered to marriage, that parenthood is what gives you a legal obligation to children. I believe that parenthood, the decision to undertake parenting together, and that would be for a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple, entails not just responsibilities towards the child, but responsibilities also towards one another if you're going to be in an economically interdependent unit. I just don't think that's about marriage, and that we don't need an institution of marriage to have a legal regime that assures that children are cared for. I'd like to say, in addition, that all of the talk about raising children within marriage and how critical that is really demeans the work that single, unmarried mothers do, raising children, and for the most part, raising them extremely well, even though in our culture they are stigmatized. And so the perpetuation of the notion that children have to be raised within marriage is part of what makes women stay in bad marriages, violent marriages, marriages that actually aren't good for their children. That, yes, I'm very concerned about child rearing. I just don't think connecting it to marriage is the way to go.
Is anyone seriously advocating this kind of change to the legal system of marriage?
There are a number of people who've been writing about it for some time. The report I referred to before out of the Law Commission of Canada that came out about a year and a half ago, it's called Beyond Conjugality, Recognizing and Supporting Close Personal Adult Relationships, and it does fall just short of completely eliminating marriage as a legal institution, really just for the practical reason that they say they don't think the majority of people in Canada are quite ready to go for that, although they do think it's something to be seriously considered. But what it does is review every aspect of Canadian law and come up with a method of building into the law what relationships between adults ought to matter for purposes of a particular law, given whatever that law's purpose is. Right. And marriage then doesn't become a bright line that means anything under the law the way they've proposed it. And
all right, we're going to continue this discussion on marriage when we return. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Continuing our discussion on the role of the state in marriage, my guests are Nancy Cott, professor of American history at Harvard University, and Nancy Polakoff, professor of law at American University Law School. Let's take some calls now. We've got a lot of people hanging on. Let's go to Steve in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Lynn. Great show, great topic.
Thanks.
Let me, I'll start by saying that my wife and I are coming up on our fifth anniversary here in October. We're both children of divorced parents, and listening to the conversation, my ideas of marriage have changed even since I've been married in terms of same-sex marriages, etc. I do feel in some ways, I'm for that. I'm for the idea of a loving couple in a legally bound relationship, I think. My question was in regard to polygamy as a potential topic or concern. How would the state address, or how would we address that if marriage wasn't ruled at all, had no guidelines set to it? How is topics like that addressed?
Professor Polakoff? Hello, Nancy Polakoff?
If there isn't a legal institution of marriage, then there's no such thing as polygamy as a legal matter, and people may still choose to observe within their religion whatever their religion's definition of marriage is. But that wouldn't be the business of the state in any way.
You don't think that takes away from society by having no guidelines or laws for, I mean, for the idea of a family, you know, the idea of a family thing is very important for children, no matter if it's a single mother family, if it's same-sex marriage, or, you know, togetherness family. How does that, it just seems to me like everything is lost if there's no rules whatsoever to bind it.
I'm not advocating no rules when it comes to responsibility for children. I think that there are obligations. I also think there are obligations of society at large through the public that are not filled very well at all in our current system of failing to provide for the social welfare of children and failing to recognize the public responsibility that we all share for the raising of the next generation of children. But I just don't think that needs to be tied to marriage. I think we need to think about what we want to accomplish, and then we need to figure out what makes sense to accomplish that. And the link between the notion of a legal marriage and making sure that children are well cared for is a leap that people make easily as a matter of custom, but it's not necessary, and it's not necessarily the best way.
All right, thanks for your call, Steve.
If I could just interject here in response to Professor Polakoff's remarks, I think that what is more likely in following up on her principles, but more likely than the elimination of marriage as a legal matter, is its supplementation along the lines of the Canadian model she suggested. It's supplementation by a legal structure being awarded to non-conjugal couples, either same-sex couples and or, as it's happened in France too, although I don't know the details, allotting some of the privileges and benefits that married couples currently get from the law to other self-declared couples who might be, say, an aunt and a niece, or two sisters, or two brothers, or two very close friends who are assuming responsibilities for each other and for any dependents they might have, who are willing to do that, that the state might accord them some privileges, as well as recognizing that they're taking on the responsibilities. That would, I think, accomplish some of what Professor Polakoff is getting at as a lack in our current system.
All right, we're going to try and get one more call in here. PJ in Sacramento, California. Hi, PJ.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm a retired person, and I am cohabitating. I have a domestic partner, and the reason we have chosen not to get married is because the inheritance factor for our children and the thought that one person might die before the other and how that complicates the inheritance situation is why we've chosen not to get married.
And is that fine with you? Are you?
Oh, I'm perfectly fine with it. I think he has a little more trouble with it than I do. But I think it makes it a lot clearer for the children, and it causes no jealousies.
That's an interesting take. Nancy Cott, here's an example of how a person feels that because the state controls it, they just don't have anything to do with it again.
Right. This is a model I'm familiar with among people of my mother's generation, and I think it's very rational, as the caller described. I do think that if more people of every generational cohort simply opted out of marriage in that way, as one of the early callers had as well, that would be a far more radical move than, for instance, allowing same-sex marriage. There are two ways to move away from the traditional model of relation between the state and marriage. One is to increase the groups or numbers of kinds of people who can marry. The other is simply to drop it altogether as a legal matter.
Okay, thanks for your call, PJ.
Can I make a comment on that?
Sure.
I think it's true that the idea that if people walked with their feet, then there would be some changes as a result of that socially. But as Professor Cott points out in her book, the institution, it doesn't look coercive, but the more coercive it is, the less coercive it looks. For example, as long as we have health care in this country tied to private health insurance, and as long as that is primarily available through employers, it means that if you have two people who are operating as somewhat of an economic unit, but only one of them has a tie to the workforce, or only one of them has a tie to a job that provides health benefits, that the difference between the the health and the lack of health of the partner will depend upon whether those two individuals get married, or in some workplaces, whether they become domestic partners. My fear is that if we obtain lesbian and gay marriage, then domestic partnership benefits will disappear, and then it will be even more coercive, because it will be necessary to get married in order to get that benefit, and it will still leave the niece taking care of her aunt, or the sister taking care of a sister, in a second-class status in terms of the benefits available to close personal adult relationships.
Okay, I want to thank both of my guests for joining us today. Nancy Polakoff is a professor of law at American University Law School, and Nancy Cott is a professor of history at Harvard University and the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. Join us next week at this time when we move our discussion on family to those who decide not to get married. We'll be exploring the concept of urban tribes.